Hi, I'm Jada Cesar, mental health and body positive advocate.
And I'm Louise Troen, the Vice President of International Marketing and Communications at Bumble.
And welcome to Unsubscribe, the podcast that aims to help you unsubscribe from the negative habits in your life and resubscribe to healthier, happier modes of living. We're joined by a host of amazing guests for our first series who are pioneering the way in their respective industries and breaking boundaries along the way.
This podcast is brought to you by Bumble, and we are the social networking app that's focused on encouraging women to make the first move in love, in friendship, and in business. The first movers on this podcast are real testament to what can be achieved when you go after exactly what you want.
Laura Mann is a breast cancer survivor and all-round extraordinary woman. She is championing the reframing of the disease and building communities to empower those that are suffering or those that have loved ones that are suffering with it too. She built the platform Girl Versus Cancer, which prides itself on being a place for commentary, conversation, and awareness to help those feel empowered. She is honest, inspirational, and oozing with positivity. Now let's get started.
The last year for me has been, I don't have objectives for it. It's been crazy in the best possible way. I feel like the best way to describe my life is from extreme low to extreme high. My life is very far from linear. So obviously being cancer-free is one of the best things ever. And last year, I feel like it was the first year I went into a year really not in active treatment and kind of starting to rebuild who I was. Or try and get back to who I was. And you start to realise that that's never going to happen. Cancer kind of changes you in, not even just physically, like mentally, in every single way, relationships. So it's kind of settling yourself back into, okay, this is my life, but this doesn't fit and you have to make a lot of changes. So there was really exciting things about that, like including leaving my job and doing Girl Versus Cancer full time, doing the podcast, you know, doing all these really cool and amazing things, opportunities that are coming my way from the work I've done. So that's extreme highs. Yeah. And then there's like extreme lows. So, you know, Rachel from the podcast, my co-host, is one of my best friends, and she died last year. And that in itself was, and I don't think I've really processed it at all. I don't think I've really dealt with it because I've just been busy. Just keep going and it won't hurt. And that's been an extreme low, like realising that, you know, my body's not where it was. The fact that I haven't had a sex drive for about a year is hard work. At 34, I'm like, whoa, where's it gone? So there's, I feel like my life in the last year has been amazing because there's been all these opportunities and I'm happy and I feel like I'm getting back to life. I'm coming back to myself, but also the lows, because of the nature of what I do, are quite severe. So for me, I do feel like I've really got to watch my mental health a lot of the time, because if I was just plodding along linear, there'd be little bumps, but these are like massive high, massive low, massive high. And that extreme can be quite a toll on the old noggin, really.
Can you, for people that might be meeting you newly today on the podcast, can you take us back a little bit to before you were diagnosed with cancer, and kind of how that situation presented itself and how you kind of got to where you were last year, just the beginnings of that situation?
So let's go back to 2016 summertime, living my best life, Glastonbury with my friends. I just moved out of my parental home in Fulham, moved to Hackney with friends. It was brilliant. I just got my independence, really felt like I was living. I was a social media manager, really, like a premium handbag brand that I loved. It was my first manager role, so my career was going in the right direction. And I found a lump in my breast towards probably beginning of June. I've got really small boobs, so I noticed it quite quickly and I was like, that's a big boy. But I thought it was a cyst that size. So I didn't really worry about it. And when it hadn't gone by the end of June, I was in a tent at Glastonbury with my best friend. And I was like, please, can you feel this? And she's like, yeah, it's quite big. So I went and got it checked and they told me not to worry. I'm 31. Okay. And I was like, okay. So I said, can't you just scan me here and now? I was in the hospital walking centre at this point. I just moved house, so I didn't have a doctor. Anyone who lives in London knows what it's like. You have to have like your first bills and stuff before you can register anywhere. So I, because he'd said that to me and he didn't scan me on the spot, I was like, I don't need to be worried. So off I went, had a really great summer, went to weddings, everything. And then in August, it still hadn't gone away. So I went to my, I then registered for a GP. I told them that I'd had a lump. They registered me on the spot, got me in. They were great. Got me to the hospital within a week. And that was kind of the beginning of, I say, Laura Mark too. That was when life changed, really. went to the hospital. I'd only took the morning off work. I was like, they're going to scan me. It's going to be a cyst and I'm going to go back to work. And that didn't happen. Like, they scanned me and the whole room changed and they were like, we're going to biopsy. And I was terrified. I am so bad. Considering like all the stuff that's happened to me now with surgeries and stuff, I'm terrible with needles and stuff. So when they were like, biopsy, I wasn't actually scared of cancer. I was actually really scared of the biopsy. So I did the biopsy, but I knew... And I said this to my family and no one wanted to hear it because you wouldn't. I was like, I've got cancer because I could just tell from how everyone behaved. And then I got the news that I knew was coming a week later. I was told I had cancer. I was told, you know, the cancer was aggressive. It is a fast growing cancer because it was hormonally driven and the protein in the breast, which is ironic as hell, considering I don't have really big boobs. And the epidermal growth factor in my cancer made it aggressive. So the thing basically that makes your boobs grow is making my cancer grow fast. And I was like, what? This is some kind of cruel irony. But I had to laugh at that point.
When they were presenting you all this language that was probably quite foreign to you, how overwhelming was that in terms of, you know, words like aggressive and, you know, for a lot of people that I know have been through similar experiences, a lot of the delivery and the language that is used is almost like part of the reason why it's so frightening, because that's not normalised. And when you think of language like aggressive or tumour or cancer or chemo, it feels very ultimate.
Yes.
So I'm interested, how did that make you feel?
I thought I was going to die. I said it. I said it to her. I was like, I don't want to die. I started crying and she said, you're not going to. And I kind of looked at her like, what? Isn't that what cancer does? And she's like, look, we can't make promises, but we're really confident because of what your cancer's made from that. We can get rid of this and we can, like, you, that this is a really good prognosis, actually, even though it was a big one and it was a big lump in a very small breast and it was aggressive in terms of growth. To be honest, in that moment, I always say it's almost like an out-of-body experience. You know those rides that you go on that, like, drop you, like, at Alton Towers and stuff?
Yes,
and
the worst rides.
Yeah, I hate those.
I don't go on them.
No.
Because they are the worst ever. Yeah. But that is what it feels like. It literally felt like, for me, the world dropped from below me. Your heart stops for a minute. And almost like you're not in the room. Like, I could hear my mum talking to me and I could hear, like, the doctor saying stuff. But I was just a bit like, eh?
Yeah.
And also... We'll talk about this. Prior, growing up, I've always had health anxiety. Bad. Like, had counselling for it. Used to have panic attacks and stuff. I was convinced I was going to die young. I was convinced something bad was going to happen. I was going to die young. So for me, it was almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, it's happened. I knew it would. So it was all these things going through my head. But then she was like, oh, and do you want children? And I was like, what? That's quite a personal question. Why are you asking me that? But it was because my cancer's hormonal. They had to shut my ovaries down. So within the space of 20 minutes, I'd been told that I had cancer. I'd been told I'd been made infertile and I had to make the decision there and then. Oh. Or within 24 hours, if I wanted to have my eggs frozen, because they had to do it right away. Otherwise, you know, they needed to get me into treatment.
And stepping out of that room after hearing those kind of, that result, like, well, how long did it take you to sort of process all that information and what was that processing journey like?
It took about, the nurses say to me, it's going to take you a couple of weeks for this to sink in. And it did take about 2 or 3 weeks for it to really go, oh. I always say it's kind of like a bereavement. It's when you get that news, when someone dies or something bad happens, and you leave that place and you get on with your life. You wake up, you look the same, you feel the same. Everything's the same, but something has fundamentally changed forever. That's exactly what happens with cancer, the same thing. I slept in my mum's bed for 2 weeks. And I didn't go back to work. Like, I said, look, I need to talk this out. There's a lot of scans. There's a lot of procedures that happen. They have to check the cancer hasn't spread. And luckily for me, it hadn't, touched wood. It won't ever. But it's a real weird thing because you know everything's about to change. You know it's changed, but you're the same person. Mm-hmm. You've just realised you've got something in your body trying to kill you at that moment.
When you say bereavement, do you mean in a sense of... you're kind of losing a little bit of yourself?
You just know that there's a real loss. Like, it's heartbreak. It's heartbreak. That's what it feels like. For me, it felt like a heartbreak. I was heartbroken. My life was about to completely change, but also everything's so uncertain. And you know what it's like. You're comfortably numb in your life. You go along, you make plans. I'm off, like, I've got a holiday booked in a couple of weeks. And, you know, I'm hoping by the end of this year, we talked about all these plans for Girl vs. Cancer. And you just think about tomorrow. and what you're going to do. And but what all of a sudden, if that rug's pulled, and they're like, well, you might not have one. And actually, you're not going to be going to that holiday because you're going to be sat in a chemo chair. Mm. It's that. It's the heartbreak of, like, life can literally be pulled from you at any moment. And it's that realisation. And I'm trying to... For me, it was a settling process in my mind. Like, I was terrified, but also I had to get my mind in the right space for what was about to happen. Mm. Mm. Because, you know... It is so easy and too right that you can go down the rabbit hole and kind of really in a very dark place. And I just know from my mental health past that if I allowed myself to do that, that probably wouldn't be the best thing for me.
And what did you find were your strategies in order to sort of pull yourself out from that dark hole and in that times where you were sort of maybe in your own head too much? What did you do?
I had CBT in my mid-20s for anxiety and depression, and that kind of didn't really come into play until I got ill. So I kind of used those strategies where, you know, I always use the train analogy. Like, a train comes into the station of your mind and it's a negative thought or a scary thought or a panic, and you have two options, and you can either get on the train and go down the track with it and you end up in bloody a panic attack, or you can acknowledge the train and go, thank you for stopping by, but I'm going to stay here on the platform, and you let it go out, or you get on a different train, or you do something else. And that's kind of what I did with my mental state. I think Girl vs. Cancer, I've always said, is the biggest example of a distraction technique, I think, ever. Mm-hmm. I decided very early on, the next day, basically, I sat with my mum. Well, that night, when I found out, I went to the pub with my friends, obvs. Ordered all the Prosecco, obvs. And I was just like, it's going to be fine. They've said it'll be an inconvenience. I'm going to survive. It's going to be fine. Just got drunk. I was like, I'm going to do something about this. And I already knew in the back of my head that the fact that I got diagnosed at 31, the girl with no tits, any one of my peers could, and none of us were checking our breasts. Mm. So I knew that I wanted to do something good. So almost that became my focus rather than what was about to happen. So when all these scary things were happening, I was like, oh, I could talk about this on social media, and I could tell people about this process because I never knew this would happen. So that became my coping mechanism. And also, like, my mum is one of the most amazing women. When I sat with my mum, I cried my eyes out the next day. One of my best friends came to see me and held my hand, and I was just crying. I was like, I think it hit very suddenly what had happened. And I was like, I don't want to die. Like, why me? And my mum went, right, one, you're not going to die. She went, two, because we weren't having that. My mum was like, nah. And then second of all, I said, but why? Why me? Why has this happened to me? She went, why not you? Mm-hmm. Why should it be anyone else other than you? Mm. And I looked at the woman, I went, oh, Tina Mann, profound. But it was a really big moment, actually. It made me go, oh, I'm going to stop feeling sorry for myself, because she's right.
And did your mum have cancer?
She had cancer at 26, yeah. Yeah. 6-week-old baby.
So that attitude has clearly been the foundation that has enabled you to create Girl vs. Cancer and all the community work that you do. And I know you do so much in the space to expose cancer to women in their 20s and 30s especially. I wanted to just ask you, you know, how much more unjust did you think the diagnosis was because women of our age aren't really exposed to it in their 20s and 30s? You know, you typically see women in their 50s or 60s being diagnosed with it. How did that affect sort of your reaction and empower you even further to do more for younger women?
I think it was because I genuinely, and I know I feel silly saying it now because that's my mindset, I genuinely thought you had to have an ample bosom to get breast cancer. I never classed myself as having boobs. Mm. Like, I've never had a relationship with them because they're so small, they're barely there. So I didn't think I would ever get breast cancer. I thought you had to have a proper boob, and I thought it was something that happened to older women because that's all we ever see. So when I got diagnosed, I was like, this is really dangerous. And the more I started speaking to the community, and I knew of Chris Helenga from Copperfield anyway, mm-hmm. From the work that she did, and I watched her documentary before, and I thought, how can young women are getting diagnosed at really late stages? Because as what happened to me, they're being sent away because you don't fit the criteria of this is what cancer looks like. And actually, that's a really dangerous thing. And I also feel like as young adults, we're taken into a room in school and we're told to put a condom on a banana, but we're not taught about our own bodies and putting self-care things like processes in place for ourselves from a very young age. Like, if I was taught that that checking my breasts or getting to know them. It's not really checking them. You're not checking them for cancer. You're just knowing what's your normal. Same as you would know what is your normal period or whatever. But we're not told, you know, that's something you should be doing and the reason why and what are the things you should be aware of if there's a change. So, yeah, I felt really strongly that, you know, we're talking about cancer, but we're talking about it in a way that's scary. I know that, I know so many people that wouldn't go and get things checked because they're scared it's cancer. And I was all of a sudden very aware of like, well, if it is cancer, it ain't going away. The only way it's going is more places in your body and you won't survive that.
Yeah.
So it was kind of changing people's perception of what the disease looked like and the, what the treatment looked like. So people felt like they could, if they had cancer, if they thought there was something wrong, they can see someone surviving and getting through it. So they would know that they could do it if it was in them in their in that position. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because I feel like before I got diagnosed, cancer to me meant death. And it was a very scary thing. And it is scary and it is hard, but it's a doable thing. More people will live from cancer with cancer than will die from it now. So we need to kind of get this, we need to get comfortable with this conversation.
What would you say to somebody that was newly diagnosed that heard what you're saying now, but still couldn't face maybe, I don't know, going through treatment or like the chemo that can take a massive toll on you? What kind of advice would you give somebody to evoke some sort of strength in them?
I think you just take it a day at a time. That's all you can do. Like I'm speaking from the other end of the tunnel and at that point, for me, you don't know what's coming. And the thing is, that when you're diagnosed and you're about to start chemo, it's a terrifying thing to have to go through. Like, I remember being in the chemo chair for the first time and I was panicked. Like, I don't know how I didn't have a panic attack in that chair. Well, that is pure terror, what I felt that day. And because it's the unknown. And that's why everything I do, I try and lift the veil on what it looks like and feels like, because it's a doable thing. And people do it every day and they're fine and you can do it as well. I think the thing is, don't try and be, you don't have to be this big strong powerhouse, a person going, I'm gonna do this, because you know you may feel like, oh my god, this is too much. But all that matters is you get up, you brush your teeth, you have a shower, you go, you get in the chair, you have the medicine that is going to get rid of the cancer, fingers crossed, and make you well in the long term. And go through this in the short term. And for me as well, you know, me and Deb talk a lot on the podcast about things being temporary. And even for Deb, she's still in treatment. She'll probably always be in treatment for her whole life. But even for her, the emotions you go through daily and those moments of like panic or those treatments are a temporary emotion or a temporary process. You are going to get back out of that chemo chair. You are going to feel sick tomorrow, but you won't feel sick. You might not feel sick the day after or as sick, because it's a process. It's a cyclical thing. It comes back around. So that's what I always try, if it feels overwhelming, is to kind of sit back and stop thinking it as a big picture and just think about where you are today and what the next step is today. And that's how I got through my chemo cycles, was like, this is, I feel terrible today, but I'm just going to watch Gossip Girl and get to the end of the day and go to sleep.
I say that just because my dad was diagnosed with bowel cancer and he was told that it's really slow progressive cancer, didn't want any treatment. And so no matter what the family said and how much advice and support we had given him, essentially he didn't want to do anything about it. And so we had to see him deteriorate. I think something could have been done. I think people's identity is, it's something to kind of, people accepting that this is something out of their control is a massive thing. And I think mental health of people that have been diagnosed with cancer is something that we don't talk about, which is great, all the work that you're doing to squash that taboo and make it something that we can tackle. But I think identity plays a big role. And my dad being this like big, proud Turkish man, head of the family, for him having cancer almost stripped him of that. And I'm wondering how people can understand that their identity just changes a little bit. You're not completely going to be disassociated from who you are.
No, I literally, for me, I'm still Lauren pre-cancer in my heart, but I've got a different head on my shoulders. That is all that's changed. My perception of the world has changed. And yeah, for a while, I physically didn't look like myself, but I was still myself. You know, it's that, it's temporary. It's like, you know, you burn yourself, you get a scar, it heals. Like, it comes back around. There'll be that little mark to remind you, but you heal. And that's what I always had to try and tell myself when I looked in the mirror. And, like, when I couldn't go out and be with my friends or I had no energy, like, I identify massively with my energy, energy that I've got. I'm quite an 100 miles an hour person and quite an upbeat person. And when you don't have any capacity to be that person, it's really hard to not feel overwhelmed and to not feel defeated.
Yeah, I think a lot of what we talk about as well is in that moment of pain, like, feel through it.
Yeah,
and that's okay, because I know a lot of the time it's really easy to just put up your defense mechanisms, guard yourself from feeling hurt, and just, like, power through. I know I've done that in a lot of situations, including grieving for somebody, but actually it's important, and you have to not rob yourself of that that freedom to just feel.
You have to sit in it. I mean, I, at the moment, I know with my cancer treatment, I did sit in it a lot and it was hard, but there was a certain point I'd get to and I'd be like, right, enough, because I was scared of going to a point where I can get myself back up, if that makes sense. However, I have been through something traumatic. I've been holding my hands up and saying, I don't think I've dealt with it yet. It's a process.
Yeah.
And at the moment, it's bubbling up. It's sitting there, but rather than me doing what I always have done and CBT it away and go, hello, negative thought, off you go, I'm having to be like, okay, I need to get on this train. I need to get on the train.
So many trains.
Yeah, I need to go in every single carriage. I need to sit in every chair. But that's what I kind of need to do now. And that's in itself, accepting that I need to do that is a big thing.
Yeah.
Is a process.
I'm so, like, dumbfounded by how remarkable your attitude is. I think so much of your strength feels like it comes from this mindset. And I'm really interested, like, where that came from when you were younger, or what experiences you went through in your life that have, you know, curated this individual that is facing something so, what is so scary, in such a brave and positive and empowered way. And I think for people listening who might be going through similar things, if they're not feeling like that, I'm interested, kind of, what do you think, or how do you think that started? Was it your childhood? Is it your community? Do you think it's something that's naturally ingrained in you? Where do you feel like you get that strength from?
I think it's a mix. So I feel like growing up, I have always questioned myself and I've always worried. I have always worried. So my self-worth has never been the greatest. Growing up, like, at school and stuff, out with you, you start to feel like, oh, what's wrong with me? And then you grow up and you have relationships and you get cheated on and people treat you badly and you think, what's wrong with me? It's always you, isn't it? It's never them. It's what's wrong with you. And I feel like I always kind of had this opinion of myself. My self-worth wasn't the greatest, and I always worried whether people liked me. And then when I got into, so there was worry there on that point. And so I'd always try and people please and be like everything to everybody. And then when I, because almost like if other people liked me, then I felt like I liked myself because I felt validated in them. That makes sense.
Yep.
So like having loads of friends and having like being out all the time and having like people, oh, isn't Lauren so funny? I'm like, oh, look, oh yeah, I'm really funny. And then the minute you're on your own, you're like, oh, who am I? Do I like myself? Oh, it's that weird.
Confronting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're using all of those exterior experiences to verify what you want to be.
Exactly.
I think lots of us do. I definitely do that.
I still do it. But it was when I was younger, that was a massive component as to who I was. I felt very unsure of myself unless I was around other people who made me feel good. And, you know, you grow up and you learn it's important to feel good in who you are. But also, so I worried in that capacity. And then I got to college and I had two deaths within a very short space of time. So my uncle died very quickly. He got ill and he was only 39. And it was my first real experience of death at the age of 16. That happened. And that, again, pulled the rug from underneath me because I hadn't really experienced a death of someone close to me that I remembered. And also someone that, like, literally I was with him just before and I saw him when he was dead and like said goodbye to him, and that was the first experience of that of death, which was quite scary. And then 6 months later a friend of mine was murdered, and it all happened within 6 months. So my experience of death went from, it's something that happened to older people, to two very young people very tragically dying very suddenly, and that literally changed my life. Those 6 months just played with my mental health in such a way. I was terrified. I was having panic attacks on the bus. My boyfriend at the time, he had to be with me at all times. I was scared to be alone in case I died on my own. It's pretty, can I swear on here?
Yeah, of course.
It's fucked up stuff. Like, it's something that really ingrains on you. So my mental health and anxiety was through the roof because of that. And I didn't really know what it was because we didn't talk about mental health then like we do now. Mm. I thought something was wrong with me. I used to beat myself up a lot. To numb it, I turned to drink. I turned to substances. Mm. I would go out and party all the time. Again, to feel wanted and part of a clique because you're all together and you're having a great time and you're included. But then it was to numb what was going on underneath.
Mm. We were also desperate for those pockets of happiness and you use whatever you can gain access to
escapism
to achieve that.
Exactly. Mm. And it was really weird because I almost feel like I was killing myself to feel alive. Like I was just ruining my body to feel some kind of, to feel okay. And then I feel like it was only when I sought help myself because I was in such a dark place and I was like, this can't be normal. And someone went, have you thought of counselling? And I hadn't because we didn't talk about it like we do now. Mm. And I went and the minute she said to me, they diagnosed it with severe depression and anxiety. At this point, it happened when I was 16. I went for, I went at 24. So that's a long time to have not really had help.
Yep.
Mm. I was in a really bad headspace and it took a lot of work to get me back out of there and it took a lot of mindset changes to get me into a better place and out of that kind of scenario. So I think that's what it is. I think it's been a process my whole life to get to where I am now. Mm. I think it's obviously something that's in me. I've got people like my mum around me and really strong females that have and my dad and like my brother that have instilled stuff in me. Like, I think my brother's an incredibly brave man. But like when he came out to us when he was younger and like it was such a big move for him and he inspires me all the time. My brother is unapologetically him. He's out. He's proud. He's an amazing man and I'm so proud to stand by him. I'm surrounded by these people in my life. So I think it's a little bit of all of them, but also what I've already been through in my life and the fact that I've spent most of my adult life worrying about dying, worry about people liking me, just worrying about everything that when I got diagnosed, in that instant, none of that mattered.
No.
Nothing mattered. I'd spent years worrying I was going to die and then something bad happened and I haven't died. Why I'm not going to spend any more time doing that to myself.
I must say, I was listening. You have this incredible podcast. Big Me.
You Me,
the
Big
You, Me and the Big C. Yeah. And I remember listening to one on the train and could not stop crying. I had to get off because it was so, but in a beautiful way. I was listening to it sobbing with happiness because although you were speaking about death quite candidly and openly and reframing the idea of death and talking about it, I know you say people don't pass away. They don't like they don't pass a test. They don't come back. They die. And because it felt like the more you were talking about mortality, it made me feel like, shit, I need to live my life more. Which was, like you were saying a second ago, it's like such a juxtaposition of we're talking about the end of something, but then that realization makes you think, oh my God, I've got so much to do right now that I'm not really fully like embracing.
I think this is a human condition though. I feel like none of us want to think about the end of life. So we live our life as if it's never going to happen. And actually thinking about your end of your life, hopefully it won't be for years and years to come, but just knowing that there is an endpoint and knowing that what if it did happen tomorrow, would I have told the people that I love them? Would I have done the things that I wanted to do? Would I, for me, it was like, have I made my mark? Have I done what I want to do in this life? Have I been the person I want to be? And have I meant something to people? And that was what it mattered all of a sudden. I'm like, that's all that matters, is that I want to mean something to those that I love. And I want to leave this life with a smile on my face going, I did a good job there. Like I lived a good full life. And that, I think that is a mindset shift that we all really need to get into and stop just plodding along thinking that like we've got forever because, you know, it's not being scared of death. It's being accepting of
reality.
And I think in doing that, it will make us all better humans. You treat people with much more kindness and compassion. You know, you're a bit kinder to yourself because you're like, God, I'm not really looking after myself here. I want to actually live a long life. I need to slow down.
Yeah. And maybe you tolerate less because you're like, actually, life's too short. I'm not going to stay in this terrible job or in this terrible relationship.
Yeah, I left my job last year. I've been a year freelance. I cannot believe I have survived a year, paid my rent, freelance. I never had the minerals to go and do that before because I doubted myself all the time. I feel like the fear's been stripped away, you know? I feel like I worried so much and I was fearful of doing things or trying things in case I failed. And now I'm just like, what's the worst that's going to happen? It's going to kill me? No. The thing that tried to kill me, it hasn't. So let's just get on with trying and doing. Yeah. And if it doesn't work, can you do something else?
Yeah. Something you just mentioned earlier that I just want to reiterate because I just think it's so powerful is that you're saying that your empowerment and your strength to deal with the diagnosis and the experience of having cancer came from a plethora of other negative experiences that have happened in your life. And I think for a lot of women that listen, you know, we get messages about what they're really looking for. And what you're saying is that these negative instances and the challenges that you went through actually have formed your foundation to be able to oppose what you went through with strength. And I think that is so powerful in life to recognize that when you're in the middle of these really hard situations that can sometimes feel like the end or, you know, whether they're mental health or you've lost a family member, that actually once you have kind of grafted through that bereavement or that experience, you can actually find a newfound sense of strength that can give you an armor for the next thing that you have to face. I just think that is so powerful.
Yeah, and thank you. And I just do honestly feel like there's a process of letting go for me anyway. I'm always learning from like the community and stuff and words that I use because this is all new to me. Like no one cared what I had to say before I got ill, trust me. But when I talk about my cancer experience and I say, when you have cancer, but actually it's my experience of cancer, other people feel differently. But I feel like, what was I going to say? It just was in my head. It was really good. It was basically that, I feel like for me, having had cancer and being that close to my mortality and having to stare my biggest fear down the face and even being around Deb, Rachel, like actually having a friend die and her scenario basically being the scenario I've always been fearful of and having to confront that head on, I am learning to let go. I feel like as a species, as societally, we are so obsessed with control and curating our lives to be a certain way. And when I got ill, I realized that I have no control over this to a certain extent. But also, when I started Girl vs Cancer and all these things started happening, I was someone who's always worked in digital marketing. I've always had like these, I've got all these networks and stuff that I never utilized. And when I got ill, every single skill set I've ever learned, every single person I've ever met, everything just kind of went click, 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 to make this a possibility. And all of a sudden I just felt like, do you know what? Like, I'm where I'm meant to be right now and I'm doing things I'm meant to do. I genuinely feel for the first time in my whole life, I'm meant to be doing what I'm doing. I've never felt like I had a purpose. And now I'm like, I'm not saying, oh, I'm the savior of the cancer patient. I mean, like, I have a reason to get up in the morning. I have something I'm working towards that excites me and makes me feel like it has meaning. And I never had that before. So I think before I was desperately trying to find that in people, in jobs, in friendship groups, in clothes that I bought, in everything, trying to curate this life that I thought I wanted for myself. And actually the minute I've let go and just let life happen and just gone with what feels right, one step at a time, it's made this. This was never the plan for Girl vs Cancer. It was a hashtag. It was a hashtag to share my story.
Tell us a little bit about Girl vs Cancer.
So Girl vs Cancer is, it's now an award, a multi-award winning online cancer community and online charity store that sells tit teas to raise awareness for breast cancer and get people checking their breasts.
Not to be confused with tea bags.
Not to be confused. It's a space that basically, I got diagnosed with cancer, couldn't find women like me to talk to me about what I was about to go through. I knew loads of women who'd been through cancer. Most of them were a good 20, 30 years older than me. I was 31 years old. I just moved out of my parents' house. I don't have dependents. I was in a job, I was kicking my career off. I just wanted to go out on the weekend and have fun with my friends. I was in a very different life stage to everyone that I had met. And I was like, listen, if I've been diagnosed at this age and I feel like this, there are other women, surely. But no one was really talking about it. And in Instagram world, no one was really showing cancer in the way that I'm like, well, this is my life on Instagram. I'm not going to change the way I look on Instagram or the way I post on Instagram because I've got cancer. I'm just going to take you on this journey with me. Mm. And that's what I did. I being social media kids, I came up, I found the hashtag girl versus cancer was free. I was like, result. Mm-hmm. Started sharing my story so that if anyone clicked on the hashtag, there would be all the posts for my cancer treatment. And that is literally what I did. And then it just became something bigger than that. And people started sharing their stories with me, created a community. I started selling t-shirts to raise awareness under the same hashtag. They sold out. And basically over the last 2 years, 3 years, 2 years, 3 years since diagnosis nearly, but 2 years, a community has formed and people are sharing their stories. Girl vs Cancer has a website. It's got all information. I work with charities. I signpost people. It's still really early doors. It's only been 2 years, but it's done amazing things. I'm now on £51,700 wow. for charity. I did it up last week. And we've the Instagram page now has about 35,000 people on it. And the podcast that I'm part of with You Mean the Big C, we found out we have 1 million downloads yesterday. Wow.
And it's not just for women who have been diagnosed with breast cancer. It's for the whole spectrum of,
Anyone who's been affected by cancer. I like to think as well, a lot of feedback we get from the podcast, a lot of feedback I've had is it's people whose family and friends have been affected by cancer will come to Girl Vs Cancer in the pod because they want to know what it's like. Mm. And the way that I talk about my experience, I feel it's quite open and quite how I talk to you guys about something, I don't know, about Fleabag or something down the pub.
Yeah.
I talk about it in a way I hope isn't scary and it's quite normal. Mm. And I think by normalising the conversation, it means that people are able to find it more palatable and tap into it in a different way.
Absolutely.
And then they're feeling support, they're finding that they can support their family and friends better too. So it's not just for someone who's been diagnosed with a breast cancer. It's any cancer. It's male and female. And it's definitely for the support groups around them too. And clinicians are finding it useful too.
Yeah, and I mean, I really wish I even had the language to use that kind of that you're using to talk to my dad about it. Because I think if I had maybe, I mean, we could always say if we did whatever differently. But I think just having that language and that insight to talk to him may have, I don't know, planted a seed for him to see his cancer differently. Because I know a lot, like the older generation, he wouldn't have Googled anything or used. He had like a brick phone. He didn't even have the internet. He didn't even give me a text back. But I think if he had that information.
And the support.
Yeah.
We know that as men, there's not that out there anyway in terms of mental health. So especially in the cancer community, there's a real need. There is a need for that.
Yeah.
And like, I think it's culturally as well. Like you said, he's the head of the family. He's got to be this strong man.
Yeah.
And it's actually like, well, you're still strong. You're just ill and we'll get you better.
Yeah, and I think it's knowing that cancer it can be cured in certain circumstances. Yeah. And there's things that can be done to, you know, and you can live.
You can live a really long life with cancer. Like, it's not what it was before. You know, if you catch it early enough, you can live a long life with it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a death sentence like it used to be. In fact, what will make it a death sentence 9 times out of 10 is if it's, well, if, like the medical system let you down, it's not diagnosed early enough, or you don't go to your doctor early enough.
Yeah.
That's going to be the things really that are the biggest factors in you getting well. Yeah.
Mm. I noticed that I was reading a bunch of the stories on the website a couple of days ago, and I noticed how colloquial and fun they were to read in terms of understanding the challenges in a way that was really digestible.
Yeah.
And you want to keep reading it because you understand it in their tone of voice. And I think a lot of the medical industry in general is quite challenging to feel like you understand it because there's so much terminology that's so kind of foreign.
Yeah.
And I love that you're doing that. You're normalizing through language and you're helping people to understand experiences that they can resonate with.
It's making it relevant.
Yeah.
People don't feel like it's relevant. 1 in 2 of us will get cancer in our lifetime. So that means if it's not you, it's someone that you love.
Mm.
And I think the issue is, like you said, cancer in the media has been portrayed as this death sentence. It's scary, it's cold.
Mm.
You don't pick up the newspaper and see a story about someone. Look at them. They're 5 years, 10 years, 20 years clear of cancer. Aren't they doing well? They've opened up a new business. They've done that.
Mm.
You pick up the paper and go, look at this 17-year-old girl being diagnosed with cancer. She's got 2 weeks left. And it's a picture of her in a hospital bed with no hair.
Mm.
But that is one version of cancer. That's not what cancer looks like in general.
Mm.
And that's not what it sounds like. And it's not what it talks like. And that's why I think these stories, to share them, are so important, because it's showing this is cancer. Yeah. And these are all, everyone has a different experience. Mm. You know, there's things that unite us in what we'll go through. Most people go through the same up and downs emotionally and mental health wise, but everyone has their own experience. Yeah. Everyone is their own individual. Mm. And to lump everyone into one box and go, that's cancer, is not fair. You don't do that to parents. You don't go, that's parenthood.
Yeah.
You know, that's career. You're not all in one box. Yeah. It's like saying as a female. Mm. We're not one version of.
Yeah.
So you can't lump everyone into one box.
I really liked what you spoke about on your podcast surrounding death, going back to the episode that I listened to, and how, like what you were saying about that one experience of cancer, death isn't something that is what we see in films, which can often be a massive like car accident or a really immediate thing that's quite scary, or somebody is murdered.
Yeah, or like little violins play, like, oh, yeah, suicide, they're drifting away.
It's not all about that. Tell me about the other way that you see death.
For me, I just see death as it's going to happen. And, you know, I hope that I will have a relatively painless or like calm death. I was very fortunate that I was present for both of my grandparents. I know it sounds like a weird thing to say, but it really helped me to deal with my own mortality. It was very peaceful. They went to sleep. Mm. And knowing that the natural process for a natural human death, the process of dying is you go to sleep. That is what happens. Your body goes to sleep. You're so relaxed. You go into a deep sleep and you don't wake up. That is beautiful as far as I'm concerned. Mm. After living a hectic life, I hope that's how I go to actually have a really good sleep at the end. But I feel like it is that death is portrayed in such a way that we're made to fear it because it's so final and we're scared that it's going to hurt. It's the unknown. But I feel like by almost like confronting my death, it's making me more comfortable. So now it's like, I know this year one of my aims by the end of the year is to write a will. I'm not going anywhere. I'm not like jinxing myself, but I'm going to die eventually. So let's get the will made.
Yeah.
I'm making sure that my family and friends know what I want when I die.
Mm.
I've already decided that I'm going to be cremated and I'm going to be made into precious stones. And I want everyone to wear them because I'm nosy and I get FOMO and I want everyone to wear them so I can still like rock about. I can go to gigs. I can go to Glastonbury still or like whatever. And like, yeah, I know that if I do know that I'm going to die, I want to throw a party that I'm going to attend. I'm not putting on a big shindig for me not to be there.
Yeah.
So if I know I'm going to die, I'm going to wait to like, I'm at the point where I'm just about well enough. And I'm going to have the biggest party. I'm going to have like a festival, a Loza fest.
Yeah.
And like celebrate me and my life. And then I'll go and be like, right, off you go. I'm going to go to sleep now. Mm. I'll sort out the funeral. You guys will have a great time.
I think there's something that you said, whereas in your whole entire life, there's going to be 2 days where you never see 24 hours of the day. And it's the day you're born and the day you die.
Yeah.
And that you spoke to a lady who is either a death doula or...
Yeah, Kathy Mannix.
The nurse.
Yes, who, she's amazing.
Yeah, and she had seen over like thousands of people. Yeah. Pass away, and she was
die. Changing the language.
And and her experience of seeing people die is like what you just explained. Mm-hmm. Like it's a, like their breathing starts to slow down, and then eventually they go into like a comatized state, and then they just drift off.
Yeah,
and that really helped me knowing that because. Yeah. Again, it's like reframing the idea of this like really horrible death. Knowing that actually it can be quite, actually the majority of the time it is. Just this, it's the way that you're born. It's like birthing is so normal when like we go through the same process.
We talk about birth, we plan for birth, we do it all the time. We've got like, we talk about birth all the time. The bloody, everyone's got Instagram accounts about here's my baby and this is the birthing plan I've got.
Yeah.
We don't talk about our deaths, we don't talk about the plans we have in place.
Yeah.
And so many people die without having specified what they want and their families don't know. And that, for those left behind, is a stressful process, no? Yeah. Like funeral planning stuff, one is expensive. Two is really quite stressful if you don't know what that person's wishes were. Mm. And so you're having to make decisions for them that you don't know they'd want. What a much better place you'd leave your loved ones in if you go, this is what I want, this is how I want it done. Here's some money put aside, off you go.
Yeah, and the reason I bring up the death a lot, which is what I've been talking about over the last few questions, is because after listening to what you said about it, it made me think, I want to live my life better.
Yes.
And I'm unsubscribing from just plodding along and, you know, avoiding anything that can cause any tension or whatever. Mm. It's actually just live it.
Yeah.
Because it's going to happen. It's inevitable.
Yeah.
It's coming. So.
But also unsubscribing from the framework of what people think cancer is.
Yes.
You're literally the personification of what this podcast is supposed to be about, which is let's unstitch what society has conditioned us to think about X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
And let's restitch it in the way that makes sense for the modern day based on your life experiences and your current attitude. Mm-hmm. And I think you are remarkable and a testament to that. Something we wanted to touch on, which obviously I work for Bumble,
yes,
but you talk a lot about how being diagnosed with cancer really reframed the way you saw love,
yes,
and lust.
Yes.
And I think that's really cool that, you know, a challenging experience like that can actually reframe your priorities in terms, yes, of love. So can you tell us a little bit about that comment and, yeah, how you kind of saw life a bit differently when it came to partnership?
I feel like, without being too deep, we're going to go deep because this is a podcast. Mm-hmm. I have not always had the best experiences of love. I probably felt like I was unlovable for a very, very, very long time. It's something I still struggle with because of ways I've been treated by people.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always said, I've always been a girl, never the girl. I was always a girl at school that everyone fancied my friends, not me. Do you know what I mean? Like they'd dump my friend, that like my friends would dump them and they'd go out with me to make my friend jealous. It was like one of those things. And like my first relationship, he was amazing. He stood by me for a lot, but we were young and he left me and got with someone else quite quickly. He's not a bad guy. That's been 20 years old. My last relationship ended because I found a girl in the house. He cheated on me. So that doesn't do a lot to your self-worth. So I just didn't really feel like I was lovable. But I always just did that thing where I'm like, one day it will happen and it will be wonderful. And maybe one day I'll have a family and maybe one day I want all these things. And then when I got told that I had cancer, other than not wanting to die, the other thing that went into my head, and I said it to the nurse, I went, I haven't got married, I had children. And then kind of, I looked around the room like, who said that? Mm-hmm. Did that come out of my mouth? Oh my God, I didn't even know that's what I wanted. And so when I started to get better, and like even during, it really made me go, do you know what, Lauren, you do want that for yourself and maybe you're going to have to do a little bit of work on yourself in terms of what you want for yourself and how you feel about yourself and know that you're worthy and the kind of men you're probably attracting and the ways you're going about dating. When I was actually in chemotherapy, I used the dating app, so I used Bumble, to kind of feel like myself and give me confidence because before I got, I've always been quite a sexual person. Like I've been single for 8 years, mate. Like I do what I want to do and I enjoy male company, let's put it that way. But
very diplomatic.
Very diplomatic. But I just feel like maybe I was kind of not treating myself very well and probably sleeping with boys because it made me feel wanted rather than because I really liked them and almost using sex as a tool in that way. Mm. And then when I got ill and I couldn't be that girl, I went out in the clubs. I weren't getting all dressed up to the nines. I weren't feeling sexy. Mm. But I still wanted to feel like me. The apps were a great place to just still be me.
Mm.
Nobody could tell that I had cancer. Like, we'd get to a certain point in the conversation, I'd be like, disclaimer, I'm in the middle of chemotherapy. But it was still great. I still chatted to people for months, like, checking in and stuff. But it just gave me a space to feel like me and feel confident. And then when I got better and I realised that I did want to get married and have kids eventually, it's just given me a different idea on love and it's made me make better decisions in who I date. I literally step back now. I really love, you know, when I go out and meet people, I never write myself off anymore. I used to be like, oh, I'd never talk to him because he won't fancy me. And I still do sometimes do that, but I have to like have a word with myself and be like, listen, just what's worse that's going to happen? He's not going to like you. Oh, well, go and chat to him. And
yeah.
It's made me a little bit more secure
in
myself, definitely, yeah.
Mm. And in terms of kind of the future, like relationships and what you're looking for, you know, we've talked a lot about fear and all those kind of pieces. What are you hoping for? You know, you're so positive and you've got so much with Girl Versus Cancer and the podcast and just your attitude. What does the next sort of few years look like for you and what are your hopes for that?
In love or in everything?
Let's go for love first.
Love first. For me, I think what I've done now is I feel like before I made a lot of sacrifices, I made myself smaller for a lot of people. I made my life smaller. I would see comments and stuff as a way, like there was something wrong with me. And now I realise that certain people had said things to me to make me smaller because they wanted to take up more room in my life. And it's almost like a coercive control thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So now I've kind of stepped back. I'm much more relaxed. I love meeting people. I love having a flirt, you know, but it's in a different way. I don't feel desperate for that validation.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a lot going on in my life. I've achieved a lot that I'm extremely proud of. So when I have still had men trying to make me feel smaller. I got told by someone in my life when I won my Triumph Award not to believe the hype. They're being phased out slowly, trust me. But I was like, but rather before I'd have been like, oh my God, am I being really like egotistical? Now I'm just like, okay, someone's ego's hurt because their friend's being successful. You can jog on. And
I love this.
No, but it's true.
And I was like, why are you quoting Drake lyrics? Just like, you know.
They believe the hype. Like, what? Of course I will believe the hype. I've founded a business chemo bed. Like, I'm allowed to pat myself on the back.
Yeah, of course.
But if
you're not your biggest cheerleader, who is? Who are we waiting on?
And I'm not walking around going, oh, how fabulous I am. I'm going, oh my God, can you believe what has happened in the last 2 years?
You are pretty fabulous.
Stop it, guys, you flirts. I feel like for me now, in terms of love, I feel like I'm building up the broken heart that I have, and I'm making sure that I know that I'm worthy and stuff. So it's so weird all of a sudden now, these men that I meet, there's comments that are said, there's ways that they behave, and I'm like, I know what your game is.
Mm.
No.
Mm.
Rather than being like, oh, but you're so pretty and you fancy me, oh my God, like I used to do.
Mm.
So that I'm excited about, because I do feel like when I do meet the right person, it's just going to be bam, no bother, it's going to be amazing. I'm not worried about meeting someone. I just know it's going to happen. I'm confident in that. And it's, someone said something to me. So I was on First Dates.
We know. Great episode.
I love it. It was one of the best things I've ever done, actually. And the guy I want the date with is really, really tall. And I said in my interview, I was like, I want a guy tall enough that I can hide behind and you can't see. And someone messaged me. She went, I know you meant that as a joke. She went, but you actually need someone to put them on your shoulders and run down the street with you. Mm. And I was like, and that is the mindset I now have.
Yeah.
I'm not hiding behind anyone.
Yeah.
I'm standing front and center, and they're just going to have to deal with the fact I'm an alpha female. And if they can't, they're not for me.
Yeah.
In terms of Girl vs. Cancer, and Polk, I don't know. My life in the last 6 months has changed beyond recognition again. What I hope for is, I hope in terms of Girl vs. Cancer that I can grow it as a legit like infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And I have so many ideas of the ways I can support the cancer community and keep changing the dialogue alongside the podcast. I'm like doing a business plan. I'm going out for funding. I want a team. I feel like the impact that I've already made just as a solo, what, imagine if there's like five of me, what we could do for people and the difference that would make. Like, that is what I'm like, you can tell what I'm talking about. It's like, oh my God, it would
She's
be
like
amazing.
Running out of the room to do it.
You're like, oh. There's so many things that I want to put in place, and I'm just having to unsubscribe from the fact that I have to do it all now and just be relaxed that it will come. I just need to take a step further. And then personally, like, I'm really loving the fact that I'm doing more broadcasting work, and I love human beings and talking and actually learning that maybe me being around other humans isn't to validate myself. It's actually for that human connection. And if things that I'm saying are helping people, then maybe that's what I need to do more of.
Mm.
So I'm looking forward to doing more talks and meeting more lovely women like you and taking part in amazing stuff. I'm doing the run with Jada on the 27th of May. So it's doing things that push me out of my comfort zone and trying everything, because you live once. So I'm just, I literally am following all these amazing little breadcrumbs that are coming in front of me, and let's see where I get to, because I don't actually know. None of us do we?
Love that.
So I'm excited for the future.
I'm excited.
Talking of breadcrumbs, is that a good intersection?
Okay, so, as you know, on the show, we have this food hour.
I'm excited.
We really wish there was a jingle to be like ding dong dong, but there's not. We couldn't afford that.
The only jingle is rappers, unfortunately. So I will. We bring our guests something that we think that they would like to eat. I have bought you some Tetley tea.
Yes.
And lots of biscuits.
Yay! Do you know what my mum's nickname's Tetley?
Oh, really?
Tetley. Tina Tetley. Amazing. No, this is perfect.
And they're all my favourites.
Thank you. And you know what, darling? This is the king of biscuits. Hobnobs are underrated. I don't know why you go anywhere else.
I agree.
They can take a good Dunkin'. They've got a chocolate cover. They've got everything you want in a biscuit. You've done a great job.
You're looking for your next campaign. Imagine sponsored by Hobnobs.
And I brought you in some Tetley tea because I feel like a lot of great conversations happen over a cup of tea.
Yes.
And I feel like what you've done with Girls Versus Cancer is open up that conversation to a wider audience, to squash the Guys, I'm so sick. You edit that part out. I can't even think. To squash the taboo around the kind of conversations we have regarding cancer, how cancer doesn't mean death, and just been really honest and open and talking about that is something that I personally appreciate, but also so many other women, 12 million women.
Oh my God.
According to the amount of downloads you've had on your podcast.
Oh, 1 million. We won't go far as 12 yet.
1 million.
Well, you never know.
We like viewers to upsell on in this room.
Sorry,
I'm saying 12.
12 million. 12 million. 12 million. And yeah, I just want to thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I'm like, honestly, I think you guys are amazing. And I love what you're doing, the podcast. I told you before I came in, I listened to them all. Oh, Bumble's like one of my, honestly, Bumble in terms of the app world is my favourite. It's for women. It feels safe. It feels great. So as someone who uses it, to be sat here is really amazing. So thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Mine are always like, as you heard, unrelated because like, I like to make a joke. Yeah. And usually they go down like a sack of shit, but we'll give it a go. So I bought you some pancake mix because not all heroes wear crepes.
Yes,
this is why I'm single, by the way, guys.
Thank you so much.
I'm really running out. Thank God we've only got one more this series.
Do you know what? But can I tell you something? I didn't actually have pancake day this year. I can't remember. I forgot. So I'm actually going to actually use these and actually make myself some pancakes. And I make a really good savoury crepe.
Fab.
Can I tell you what
this was like
it is?
4 a.m, by the way. I was like, I've got it. I've got the one.
This is great. The best thing to put on it is bacon, maple syrup and goat cheese. Thank me later.
Oh, wow.
Or fig jam instead of maple syrup.
Okay, we know. And then I also got you some mini donuts because I do not know how great women like you exist. That was a pretty bad one, but I was running out.
Oh, my God. I like it. And also really like donuts. Thanks very much. And I do have mini donuts for boobs.
But no, we're so grateful, and your story is remarkable and inspirational. And yeah, we encourage anyone that's listening to go to Girl Versus Cancer online and follow Lauren's journey because yeah, she's a special one.
Oh, thanks, guys.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Wait, before we leave, actually, what are you unsubscribing from?
Oh me.
Yes. Yeah, you.
So unsubscribing. I did. Right. So I'm gonna unsubscribe from imposter syndrome because despite sitting here with you girls and saying about the 1 million downloads and the award wins and stuff, I still feel like I am not doing enough, that someone's going to find me out, that why am I qualified to do this? What the hell am I doing? I don't know. And it's a constant dialogue in my head. So I'm trying really, really hard to unsubscribe from that imposter syndrome. Mm,
that's a big one.
It is a massive one.
Yeah, and I think it's more common than we think. I think all of us feel it at some point in different rooms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's my big unsubscribe.
Well, thanks for coming in, Lauren.
Thank you.
Loved having you. You're amazing.
And that was the phenomenal Lauren Mann.
If you like what you heard, we would love to know your thoughts. Rate, review, and share with a friend you think might like this also.
Unsubscribe is powered by Fourth Floor Creative and brought to you by Bumble, the social network where it's never too late to make the first move.